This is the old one.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yesterday we left off talking about differences between Shabbos and Yom Tov. And the most practical difference that I remember I heard from Rav Schechter, who's also brought down in Lada Sarim, has to do with chicken bones on Yom Tov. In general, the rule is on Shabbos that chicken bones are not considered muktzah after you've finished eating the chicken, because they haven't changed that much from their original state. The chicken was edible for people, the bones are edible for animals, so the chicken is food and the bones are food, and it hasn't undergone a significant change. However, on Yom Tov, even though the change is not significant, it's there. It has changed. It's changed from human food to no longer suitable for human food. And that we're machmir on Yom Tov, again, because we want to reinforce people's respect for Yom Tov, to say that those chicken bones become muktzah on Yom Tov.
Because of nolad?
Because of nolad. Yes, it's like a mid-level nolad. It hasn't changed a lot, but it changed a little, and therefore the chicken bones are muktzah. Now, I'm not talking about chicken bones that still have meat on them. So sometimes, you know, if you turn over the triangle from the chicken bone, you can scrape out a little bit of meat from the under, you know, from underneath it. So that would still be totally non-muktzah, because it's still suitable for human consumption. If you find somebody, like, you know, give my kids, you know, a chicken, and they're like, you know, I finished the chicken. Right, and you're looking, like, you can cut off, like, large chunks of meat from it still. So those are not the bones that we're talking about. We're talking about a bone that a person really knows how to polish off all the meat from those bones. And all that's left is the bone. There's nothing left on the bone which is suitable for human consumption. And that's just a type of nolad which is going to be usher on Yom Tov. So we talked about there's a balance. On the one hand, Yom Tov is more lenient than Shabbos, because Torah Ruchal Nefesh. It justifies movement of all types of muktzah. Like, you could have something very, very expensive blocking your access to food. You could have a rack or a branch blocking your access to food. Even though those things are muktzah machmas kufa, muktzah machmas kesel and kif, just move it aside. The tzura kufa nefesh overrides the prohibition of muktzah. But on the other hand, you also have these stringencies when it comes to, let's say, not using matches except for their designated purpose, not using firewood except for their designated purpose, and this halacha about considering these chicken bones to be nolad on Yom Tov is totally muktzah. On how do you clear up your plates on Yom Tov, so maybe make sure to leave a little bit of meat right on the chicken bone. That way it stops from being muktzah. And if you didn't leave any meat on it, you can put some other food on the plate, and that would justify carrying the plate off the table. But you definitely have that idea. The big shaila comes up, and I don't want to talk about this now, but I'll just raise the consciousness about this. What happens when it's Shabbos and Yom Tov at the same time?
You take the chumrah?
No, we're not like knee-jerk chumrah people. Right? It's got to be right? every chumrah. The idea of a chumrah is it's something which maximizes my chances of making Hashem happy. Right? So you know you got to weigh the chances when it comes to every single individual chumrah. If I say, wow, you know this is really going to increase my chances by like 20%, right? That's a chumrah which I'll be very excited about. But if it's a chumrah that's going to increase my chances by like 0.5%. That's a chumrah that I'm not going to be so excited about. Every chumrah needs to be taken on its own. So the question is, what are the arguments, pro and con, right, for being machmir when Shabbos falls out on Yom Tov?
So the chicken without bones. So the schnitzel.
Okay, schnitzel would definitely do the trick. But maybe Simchas Yom Tov requires bone chicken. It depends what your taste is. So what are the arguments? Why should we be strict when Shabbos falls on Yom Tov? Why should we be lenient? So the reason, right? The reason to be lenient, right, is as follows. The whole reason that we're strict about chicken bones on Yom Tov is because we're afraid that people are going to say, "Hey, Yom Tov, Tzurich Kol Nefesh is mutter, and we can pretty much do anything we want on Yom Tov," and so they're not going to take the holiday seriously. But when Yom Tov falls out on Shabbos and Tzurich Kol Nefesh is not allowed, Right, so there's no concern that people are going to take it less than seriously. It's a day that everyone's going to be treating that lachos very seriously because Torah Chorcha Nefesh is aser. There's no way that they're going to treat it lightly. And so we don't need to bring in this chumrah, right, of nolad being aser, and of half nolad being aser on Shabbos that falls out on Yom Tov, because people are going to treat it seriously even without this chumrah. So that's the argument to be lenient. On the other hand, the argument to be strict, right, is a little bit harder to articulate. But no plug. So basically there's this rule when it's Yom Tov, so nolad, half nolad is aser, and today is Yom Tov, therefore half nolad must be aser. Okay, so maybe it's a sort of low plug. Maybe we do it on Shabbos Yom Tov in order that people shouldn't be mezalzel in regular Yom Tov. It's a little bit harder to articulate what the argument is. Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Although that halacha about invitations, is that like a Shulchan Aruch halacha, or is that a practical advice based on the Shulchan Aruch halacha? Okay. So there you go. That's a raya. It happens to be that this is a big machlokas. Even if you look in the contemporary Hilchot Mukta books, I think that the Art Scroll is lenient and Feldheim is strict. Amongst the Sfaradi poskim, I think the Ben Ish Chai was strict about this, and Rav Ovadia Yosef has a whole Rav Ovadia Yosef has a whole tshuva where he argues in favor of being lenient, and so it's unresolved up till this day, right? Depending on which sefer you open up, right, you'll find either that it's mutter or that it's aser.
People who walk a little way, like myself, the distinction between Yom Tov and Shabbos is if on Yom Tov there has to be a little left on the bone, and on Shabbos there doesn't have to be.
Okay, that's one way of putting it. Again, the basic rule is, we're going to get to this hopefully in tomorrow. Right? There's three levels of nolad, right, which means that something has changed its state, changed its identity. There's what's called nolad gamur, which is something which has changed radically from the way that it was originally. Then there is half nolad and nolad she'eno gamur, which is something that changed a little, but not incredibly drastically. And then there's something which didn't change significantly at all. So when something is nolad gamur, it's aser on Yom Tov and it's aser on Shabbos. So for example, if you take, let's say, a wooden spoon and you chop it up into splinters, right, and you want to use them as a toothpick, right? So that would probably be nolad gamur, right? But again, if you take something that was suitable for human consumption, now it's only suitable for animal consumption, right? A piece of chicken on the bone, suitable for human consumption, and you've taken the chicken off, the bones alone are only suitable for animal consumption. That's nolad she'eino gamur, and that is aser on Yom Tov and mutter on Shabbos. So that's the practical case, and it concerns certain types of pits from fruits as well, either because those pits are suitable for animal consumption, right, or maybe because you can play kugelhopf with them or something like that. Right? But that's the same idea, right? Those pits might be nolad she'eino gamur, and there will be muktzah on Yom Tov, but mutter on Shabbos. And then the question that's supposed to deal with is what happens on Shabbos. Falls out on Yom Tov. Okay, so that was just covering up stuff from yesterday, and what I really wanted to talk about today was the question of haramas, which means doing something tricky in order to avoid transgressing at Hilchos Muktzah, doing something a little bit insincere in order to avoid the transgression. And so if you take a look at scenario number 11 here on the sheets, right, there's a laptop, right, at the tail of my table, and not at the head of the table. If it's at the head of the table, so then, well, laptop's not even such a good example, right, because it's a mukhtamachmas before a cheson kiss or whatever it is. But, it's at the tail of the table, so it's not really in a space, that I need. So the question is, can I change around the seating configuration in order to need this space now, Right? And therefore that would give me a license to move the laptop. May I decide to sit at the tail for Kiddush and Hamotzi, thus permitting me to move the laptop at Tzorach Mekomo, and then go back to my regular seat, for the rest of the meal. Or what if I sat at the tail for the whole meal? Is that any better? Right, would that permit me to move the laptop? So again, laptop might not be the best example. It might be Muktamach Mas Kufo, it might be Muktamach Mas Kasrim Kis, depending on the household situation. But let's say a hammer, right, or something along those lines, which you need to move, which you would be allowed to move with Torah on the Komo. Right, another example of this would be, let's say that I've got this hammer at the edge of my table, and I know I can only move it, Letzorech Muto or Letzorech Mekomo. So I go down the block knocking on people's doors, asking if they have a coconut, right, and I'm going to borrow a coconut, right, and then I'll use the hammer to open the coconut. Oh, now it's Letzorech Gufo, right, so I can put it away where it belongs. Is that allowed, right, because I am using the hammer ostensibly by Letzorech Gufo? Right, or perhaps it's not allowed because really what I'm trying to do, right, is move it shelo letzorech klal. I'm just trying to get it off of my Shabbos table.
What you want in this case is a klisha lakol l'isur. That's what Vin was talking about here, as opposed to you're trying to make it that you wouldn't be allowed to move it.
I'm trying to create a situation, right, where I'm allowed to move this piece of laptop.
Why do you say the laptop is a bad case?
It might be Muktzah Machmas Gufo or Muktzah Machmas Kasrun Kis, and then I wouldn't be allowed to move it even the Torah Gufo or Makomo. It might. Again, it depends on the household situation. Right, but again, so these are cases which are described by the Gemara as haramas, right, arma, right, which means doing something a little bit tricky, and the basic characteristic, right, of these haramos are that there's a single action, depending on my sincerity, depending on my intention, this action can be permissible, right, or this action can be impermissible. And I have two intentions. Right, one of them is the hidden intention, which is to move the object for a non-permissible reason. I want to move this laptop, right, for a non-permissible reason, just to make the table look nicer. And then I have my stated intention, the one that I actually articulate, right, which is, I'm moving it by letzorech mekomo. So the question is, when you have that type of mixture, right, of permitted intentions and forbidden intentions, and how do we decide which intention is dominant? How do we decide whether this action is permitted, right, or whether the action is forbidden? So we had this red.
There's always a problem with comments of things. All kind of meandering is really whether you do the silver light, no?
Can you elaborate?
He's talking about Mechirat Chametz, is a haram.
Yes, okay, Mechirat Chametz is a harama. The Hefer Mechira is a harama. There's actually something very, very important which Rav Kook says about the Hefer Mechira on Shmita. Right? The idea basically is you're not allowed to farm land in Eretz Yisrael on Shmita, but there are some poskim who say that if the land doesn't belong to a Jew, so then all of its Kedusha disappears, and if its Kedusha disappears, then all of the obligations and the mitzvos, right, that come along with that Kedusha also disappear. And therefore, the argument goes, if you sell your farm, right, in Eretz Yisrael to a non-Jew, so then the Kedusha disappears, and all of the Shemitah obligations disappear along with it, so you could farm it as if it's an ordinary piece of land. It's very, very controversial. You go to Eretz Yisrael, every Shemitah, right, there are big arguments about it, and it's a classical example of a harama. I'm selling my farm, right, to a non-Jew. Of course, I'm going to buy it back, after Shemitah, and the question is, what justifies, right, those poskim who say that it's allowed? So Rav Kook made a very, very interesting argument. He said that in general, every law has the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. And under most circumstances, the letter of the law and the spirit of the law go hand in hand. In other words, that the letter of the law contributes to the fulfillment of the spirit of the law. I mean, you can go through, right, any law, you put tefillin on, right? So there's a letter of the law, and then the spirit of the law, whatever the kavanah of tefillin is that it should remind us that our heart and our brain should be dedicated to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, should remind us of the truths and the maxims of Judaism that are written inside the parashiyos, of the tefillin, and pick any mitzvah, the letter of the law and the spirit of the law usually go hand in hand. Shabbos, Right? The idea is to create a day of spirituality, of connecting with ourselves, with our families, most importantly, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? And, you know, to revive, you know, our ruchnius, and the letter of the law, which is about, you know, not doing malacha and making kiddush and stuff like that. Right? These are all things which promote, right, the spirit behind Hilchos Shabbos. So Rav Kook says, ideally, right, Shemitah was meant to be a year of Shabbos. It was meant to be a year when farmers would be able to take a sabbatical. They will be able to take the year off and devote themselves, right, to spiritual pursuits, to renewal and refreshment and reconnecting with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And in order to facilitate that, the Torah says that Tivisias Birchasi Lachem Bashana Hashishis Yasas Es Hatirua L'Shlosh Hashanim. The Torah says that when Shemitah was the Oraisa, right, when the land of Israel was biblically obligated, right, in that everybody there had to biblically observe the mitzvah of Shemitah, so there was a special bracha that in the sixth year, Erev Shemitah, there was 3 years worth of produce, the land will make three times as much as usual, and that way the farmers would have enough in their storerooms, right, that they would be able to feel totally secure when Shemitah came in. They had enough put aside in their savings account and in their food pantries that they could spend the entire Shemitah, right, learning and doing mitzvot without having any concern for their financial well-being. However, Rav Kook says, when the Jews were exiled from Eretz Yisrael, so as long as more than 50% of the Jewish nation is living in Galus, so the mitzvah of Shemitah is not midyaraisa, meaning that midyaraisa, when Moshe Rabbeinu came down from Har Sinai, if the law is the same now as it was back then, we wouldn't observe Shemitah at all. Right? And that's why there is no bracha, because the bracha applies to Shemitah midyaraisa. When Shemitah is obligatory midyaraisa, then we'll get that bracha of the 6 year producing 3 years worth of produce. But since it's not obligatory midyaraisa, the rabbis of some later legislature got together and said to observe Shemitah, so we don't have those 3 years, which means that all the farmers, right, who are taking it upon themselves to observe Shemitah are putting themselves into a very uncertain financial situation. What about their contracts? What about, you know, what about their livelihood? How are they going to pay their bills? There are many, many reasons why observance of Shemitah is difficult nowadays. And of course, there's all sorts of tzedakah organizations, there's creative ideas of what you can do with the land which is permissible on Shemitah. But the fact is that it's very, very difficult. Farmers who are taking off on Shemitah usually are not going to the Beis Medrash and spending the year learning and focusing on mitzvot and spirituality. Usually what they're doing is they're racking their brains with incredible anxiety, trying to figure out how they're going to pay their bills during the peak of the year. And that's, Rav Kook says, when the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, right, are marching not in step, right, when the letter of the law doesn't actually contribute to the fulfillment of the law's spirit, right, but rather actually perhaps it takes away, right, from the fulfillment of the law's spirit. So that might be a time when harama becomes, you know, not only permissible, but desirable. And that was his argument when he paskin that, you know, that the Heter Mechira was allowed. His argument was, what makes it allowed, right, is the fact that this harama is contributing, right, to the fulfillment of the spirit of the law, or at least it's minimizing, right, the interference, like, between the letter of the law as it exists, you know, in contemporary circumstances and the spirit of the law. This is why, actually, there's a number of posts who say that if Rav Kook were alive nowadays, perhaps he would have retracted, right, his sanction of the Heter Mechira, because the situation, the agricultural financial situation, is far less dire nowadays, right, than it was back in the times of Rav Kook. People are able, right, even though, yes, there still is anxiety, but it's not a matter of life and death, it's not a matter of survival, that there are multiple ways, right, that farmers can, you know, still earn a parnasa, you know, on Shemitah. And so there are some people who argue that nowadays it is possible, right, to observe Shemitah and fulfill the spirit of the law as well. And so there's back and forth about whether Rav Kook would have said what he said were he talking about the contemporary situation. And that's going to be relevant also, right, for Hilchos Muktzah. Again, the Merkavet HaMishnah pointed out, right, that the goal of Hilchos Muktzah is definitely to reinforce the Menuchas HaShabbos, Right? That Shabbos should be a day of rest. It should be a day when we're not distracted, right, from spirituality, but which sort of guides us, right, to focus on spirituality, on our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right, on our love for mitzvot. But at the same time, he says it's definitely possible that that if you make the laws too onerous, they can transform into a shmisa shel tzar, right, a painful, anxiety-inducing type of Shmira Shabbos, and that certainly is not desirable. We talked about this a few days ago, that when the Poskim had this compromise, when it came to a Kli Shakol Malachto L'Isser, right, where we'll say that if it's, you know, really necessary, right, to move it, L'Tzorach Gufo, L'Tzorach Mekomo, we'll say it's Mutter. But if it's not really so necessary, in other words, if you can have an enjoyable, you know, Shabbos without it, so then we prefer to treat that as Muksa Machmas Gufo. And perhaps we'll find a similar idea, right, when it comes to Harama. And again, based on our book, we could expect to find a similar idea to that, meaning that when this harama is really necessary in order to enhance, right, our enjoyment of Shabbos, to remove the element of tsar, right, from our shvita and our menucha, so then perhaps, you know, the harama will be more likely to be mutter, as opposed to if this is not really so strictly necessary, I can have a perfectly spiritual and enjoyable Shabbos without the harama, so then perhaps we'll be a little bit less likely to permit it, because again, it's, you know, the spirit of the law can be fulfilled perfectly well without employing this harama. So that's something which is worth thinking about. It's not going to be the main halakhic criterion for determining whether harama is mutter or whether it's asur, but it's something which always, you know, has to stay in the back of our mind. So let's take a look. The main source for the idea that harama is mutter, the Magen Avraham says it's a Yerushalmi, and he says, and it's also, right, because Yerushalmi and the Bavli don't always agree, so you always try to bring a proof from the Bavli. Also, the Magen Avraham says it's also a Gemara, Masechta Shabbos, that Kuf Kaf Dalet Amud Beis, which is exactly where we are right now. However, there's a machlokas amongst the super commentaries, right, the Rebbe Shitra, the Prima Gadim, the Masechta Shekel, who all explain, right, the words of the Magen Avraham, which Gemara on Kuf Kaf Dalet Amud Beis the Magen Avraham is referring to. And perhaps, depending on which Gemara he's referring to, you might end up with different parameters for what type of harama is permissible. So let's take a look at the two possible Gemaras. They appear in sequence one after the other, and then we'll discuss the ramifications, right, for our case about switching the seating arrangement in order to justify moving the laptop. We're on the fourth line, last word on the line. The Af Rav. Savar la laha de Rava. Rav agrees with Rava. The Amar Rav. Mar shelo yiganev zehu tiltol shelo litzorech. Remove a shovel in order to prevent it from getting stolen. Right, that's not considered tzorech, and it's asr. You can't move a shovel to prevent it from getting stolen. Why is that so? A shovel is kli shemalachto leisr. It's mostly used for bona or for choresh or for some other malacha. And this, you know, to prevent it from getting stolen is mechama litzel. You're not using a litzorech ufo, you're not using a litzorech mekomo. And in taima, the reason that it's asr is shelo yigane, because your only justification for moving it is to prevent it from getting stolen. Aval, litzorech ufo, litzorech mekomo, but if you're moving the shovel for a permissible purpose, or to make, you know, the space available, then it will be mutter. And so Rav also paskins like Rava, which is what we accept halacha lemaisa, klisha malacha leisr, you can move l'tzorech mekomo. The Gemara says, Eini. How can that be? I'll bring you conflicting evidence, and this Eini is why we're interested in the Gemara. The Harav Kahana, ikla lebe Rav. Rav Kahana one time visited Rav Yeshiva, or his house, the Omer, and Rav said, Aisu le shuta le kahana le siv ale. Bring a shuta, right, for the kohen so that he can sit on it. What is a shuta? Machlokas Rashi says a shuta means a mitsuda, a net, like a fisherman's net. And Rabbeinu Chananel says a shuta is a construction beam. Right, both of those are kalim shemelachtam leisr. Right, both a fisherman's net and a construction beam, their main purpose, that is either trapping or building, it's a klisha malachto l'isser. And it seems that the Gemara infers, Lav, isn't this Lameimra to say, Tidavar Shemalachto Le'isr, but Tzorach Gufo in, right? If you're using it actually for Tzorach Gufo, it's allowed, but Tzorach Mekomo Lo, but not if you just need the space. Otherwise, why would Rav have emphasized those words, leisiv, ale, bring it so that he can sit on it, right? He should have just said, bring the nets, right, for the Kohen, or bring the beam for the Kohen. Why the emphasis on sitting on it? Rashi says that emphasis might be necessary, because the only justification, right, for moving it is if you're actually going to use the Letzorach Gufo for sitting, maybe not Letzorach Mekomo. The Gemara says, nah, what are you talking about? Lo. Hachi Amar Luhu, really, right, the story goes a little bit differently. He didn't say, bring a net so the Kohen can sit on it. He said, Shkulu Shuta Mikame Kahana, move the net away, right, so that the Kohen can have space to sit. In other words, maybe the net was on a chair, right, and Rav said, move the net off the chair so that the Kohen can sit on the chair, or the net was on the place where he wanted the Kohen to sit. Right, so he said, move the net away so that the Kohen can sit right over here in this Kavadika space, or not the Kavadika space, or whatever it was. He said, move it away so that the Kohen can sit there. The E-boys... There's no Harama?
There's no
Harama.
Either he needed for sitting on it, according to the first version.
Okay.
Or according to the second version,
so there's no harama because, like, okay, it's perfectly natural when a distinguished rabbi visits your yeshiva that you bring him some fisherman's net to sit on. Maybe that was normal back then, right? Or maybe this was particularly something that Rav Kahana appreciated, right? So that's, it's a little bit hard, to know. And that might be one of the reasons why this type of harama is permissible, right? I'll say for two things. Number one, that there's no way, right, that a person can tell, right, whether this is, whether this is genuine, right, whether the stated intention is the real intention or the main intention, right, or not. Right? It looks like a perfectly legitimate action. And number two, maybe there is, very much of a legitimate intention, meaning the balance between the forbidden intention and the permissible intention perhaps is weighted in favor of the permissible intention. Now again, that might depend on the availability of other seating accommodations, right, or other places, right, for the Kohen, to sit, right, that might depend on the Kohen's seating preferences. What does he like, to sit on? It might depend on what the normal custom was, in the yeshiva in terms of making, makeshift, seating arrangements. Right? But certainly, right, I think that your question indicates that this is, on the scale of things, it's a very permissible harama, because number one, it's very likely that the intentions, that the balance of intentions were permissible. And number two, it's very hard for an observer, right, to be able to discern, right, that this is being done as a harama rather than being done in all sincerity. So that's there are some poskim who go so far as to say, right, that this is not what the Magen Avraham meant, right, because this is a case where the intentions were totally sincere, right, like you said, right, the intentions were totally sincere, and so this does not justify being called a harama at all. Right? Although again, the fact that he was bringing him a fishnet to sit on does. Like a cushion.
You bring it over to the place, or you really go around and looking by this. If you have the coconut in your house,
Maybe your wife has a craving for coconut.
Right.
That's why there's
a little bit more, really out of way.
Yeah, there's a lot that's unclear, right, from the Gemara. And again, we were trying to just figure out what the outer limits, possibly are. How much of a harama is this, and how sincere is it?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're allowed to do it, then it's meant for the right purpose, so you're okay. If not, it's like anything that you do that's right or wrong.
Right. The way that I like to understand haram is that it's a mixture of intentions. Meaning that there certainly is some intention, right, to bring the chair, right, for the Hashem of Rosh Yeshiva, right, but there's also some intention to rescue these fishnets from the damage that they might suffer where they're currently placed. And the question is, like, when you have that mixture of intentions, right, sometimes I don't even know what the main intention is.
That was the next tomorrow.
So we're talking about the next
tomorrow. We have at least one more line of tomorrow, so we'll get there.
We're talking about Rav here, so we're questioning his.
I think that Rav might be teaching us that a mixture of intentions, right, is, you know, perhaps in this particular situation, we can see the mixture of intentions as if the majority or the significant majority are permissible. I'll give you one example which I'm very fond of. There's a machlokas between Sfaradim and Ashkenazim about Yibum. And Ashkenazim categorically never do Yibum anymore, and we only do Chalitza. Sfaradim, officially, are allowed and supposed to do Yibum, right? In Israel, in the 1950s, the chief rabbinate made a ban against Sfaradim doing Yibum, and Rav Avadia Yosef, this is one of the famous, you know, things, right? He came out very, very strongly against this ban, and I believe that in his, you know, regional court, because he was the head, I think, of the Tel Aviv rabbinical court at the time, so I think that he actually, you know, did a Yibum, right, supervised it in his court, right, just to show that he wasn't, you know, listening to the ban. He felt that it was an imposition of Ashkenazi standards on Sfaradim, which he felt would have very, very detrimental, you know, social consequences. But in his beautiful, lengthy tshuva, right, about it, he goes through what's behind the machlokas, Sfaradim and Ashkenazim, and about whether or not to do Yibum. He says, think about it like this. Right, Yibum, right, is at the same time, right, it's like a little bit of a mitzvah and a little bit of an avera. It's a little bit of an avera because usually a brother-in-law marrying a sister-in-law is forbidden, very, very serious prohibition, is recurring. On the other hand, right, in a case of Yibum, right, so it's a mitzvah. So it's basically a case where we push aside, right, the iser, right, and instead we transform it into a mitzvah. Now here's the Torah pushes it aside. Right, now the thing is like this. Right? On the one hand, when the people are actually performing the mitzvah of Yibum, so there's probably like a mixture of intentions, right, in their head. What if she's very pretty? Right? So he's gonna enjoy it because of her beauty. Right, and maybe in his mind, he's not going to be thinking l'shem yichud, I'm doing this purely l'shem shemayim. On the other hand, of course, he probably will, you know, also be thinking l'shem shemayim, saying, wow, if not for the mitzvah, I wouldn't be doing this. So there's the assumption seems to be, right, both amongst Sfaradim and Ashkenazim, that there's going to be this mixture of intentions, that a normal person or performs an act of Yibum, right, is partially going to have in mind, I'm doing this for the sake of the mitzvah, but partially also probably will have in mind that he's doing it for the sake of the girl. So Rebbe Badia says, the machlokas between Sfaradim and Ashkenazim is this. How do we deal with this mixture of intentions? Do we say that in order for this to be a mitzvah and not an aveira, you need to have 100% pure intentions? Right? Or do we say that even though a person has, part of it is, yes, I'm doing it between the mitzvah, but part of it is also being, I'm doing it because she's pretty, that also perhaps is already sufficient. Where do we draw the line in terms of a mixture of intentions? Again, I think everybody agrees that humans are complex creatures, and it's very, very difficult to be 100%, you know, pure in terms of intention. Sometimes people trick themselves, sometimes it's actually true, but for the most part, that usually we are a mixture, and we're fighting always to, you know, to sort of make the pure intentions dominant, right? And the other intentions, right, we fight that those should be the lesser ones. But the question is, what do you do when you have that type of a situation? And, you know, what are you able to artificially, right, create the type of situation, right, where you have, you know, some amount of pure intentions and then pump them up and pump them up and pump them up until they reach the threshold when they're dominant? Right? It's an artificial situation. You're borrowing the coconut, Right? So you've created that situation, right? And then you spend, you know, 20 minutes psyching yourself up. I'm not doing this to move the hammer. I'm doing this because I know it. And you get yourself really into the mood of having coconut, right? And then at the end of the 20 minutes, if someone took the coconut away, right, you might actually be really, really disappointed. Right, but but at the same time, right, this is an artificial situation which you created. Right? It's an artificial desire that you created, right, in order to justify, right, in order to render, right, the previously forbidden act of moving the hammer, right, permitted. So this is the complexity, right, of haramas. We certainly don't encourage people to deceive, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's impossible to deceive HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but this is a case really of sincerity, meaning a person is playing around with their own desires, they're playing around with their own feelings, right, in order to achieve the situation where moving the hammer would be permissible.
Yeah, but when you fire, and you know, with the example that you're giving with the eagle, that it says that if a person doesn't have the Shema, the blood, Chas v'Chalila, I don't want to say that, to be considered a mantra.
But that's Ashkenazi position. I mean, first of all, the blood is never going to be a mamzer because nobody can nobody can tell what's in a person's mind.
So this is saying, blame the fire. What if that split second he decides that when he's having relations with her, all of a sudden he doesn't love Ishma?
So that's the Ashkenazi position.
So you blame the, where do you draw the line? Where's the salama become from a white lie to a full-blown lie? Where do you draw the line? I mean, you blame with the...
So what does the Torah say?
What?
So what does the Torah say?
I'm saying, why get close to the fire if you don't have to be close?
Because God said so.
You know, you might sin yourself.
And it's very possible that that's a situation which is allowed also, as long as, as long as the permission...
You're going to be able to be
after
the evil? No. If they live together?
Yeah.
It's a full marriage. That's if you can't do a flincher. Okay. If you can't do a flincher, the only way you can do it is doing human one give again.
The Gemara Yavam was talked about it by Kohen or Kohen Gadol, right? If she might be over there.
The whole point of being with her is to have a kid. Who says that the first B is going to have a kid?
80 years old, you never have a kid. I mean, that's pretty far-fetched. Right. That's Ashkenazi. Again, the Sephardic position would say that as long as, you know, you're doing your best and you have a certain amount of sincere intentions, so that's already sufficient, and you don't have to worry that the intentions will be 100% sincere. But as long as the majority of the intentions are sincere, the average is sincere, whatever it might be, that's already going to be enough. And that's what Rav Avi Yosef argues. He says you don't need to have 100% sincerity, but you can have whatever, 30%, 20%, right, whatever the number is, right? And that already is you know, all that the Torah requires. So again, right, the question is, what's the number? Like, how do we assess the number, you know, ourselves? Are you allowed to artificially inflate the number, right, by getting, you know, psyching yourself up, right, in order to really want, you know, the permissible thing? And again, it's hard to know in the case of, you know, of Rav bringing these fishnets, right, for Rav Kahana, right, the fact that he's bringing fishnets might indicate that, you know, that he has a secondary motivation in mind, but at the same time he said, right, I'm bringing the fishnet for Rav Kahana to sit on it, right, almost like, you know, as if he's saying, yeah, well, Rav Kahana needs to sit on something, right? So there is a necessity, right, to bring something for him to sit on. Let's bring the fishnets. We'll say that we're bringing the fishnets for him to sit on, and that already is going to, you know, to make it that it's sort of hufo, and whatever other intentions that are not articulated, right, sort of are, you know, are tafel and eclipsed by the permissible intentions.
Maybe 1% of people, when they do the Shtar Mechira in a business, right, it's done correctly and it's done with the right intention.
The rest of them, no.
No, this is the way to do it. It's not, trust me, it's not. The guy's always concerned. He's thinking, I take my business. He's not doing it with the right of it. This is what I'm forced to do. I'm doing it. One of the nigga that kind of, that's it. No haramis. Because you're leaving it up to individuals now to decide, what do I do? And I'm going to do based on what Rob did? Rob is Rob.
There is also in the Masechta an idea that the only tell people that haramas are a layout if we know the figuration mayim. That's elsewhere in the Masechta. It might be relevant to know over here also.
You guys can fool himself and say he's a Yerush Mayim.
Well, I'm not going to tell him unless my assessment is that he's a Yerush Mayim.
So take on your cup after all the and
put it in your house.
But I think that the idea here might be that if a person follows the script, right, you have a guest, right, and you also have fishnets that are in danger of getting damaged, right, and you say, okay, let's bring the fishnets so that the guests can sit on them, so you're good. You're imitating what Rav did, and I think that would be mutter for a person who is Yerush Mayim and a person who is not Yerush Mayim, because this is a genuine... Right, this is something which is clearly has the imprimatur, right, the certification, right, of Rav. And you'll say, either Rav did it more sincerely, and this guy's doing it less sincerely. Like, Rav really wants the panna to sit on it, but this guy is really going to have more of a percentage of his intentions that are going to have to do with getting it out of danger and preventing it from getting damaged.
Well, also, it may help in terms of perspective. Unlike, let's say, or also Yibam, we're talking about here about something which is really mutter, and then the rabbis made moksa to protect you from something, and you're dealing here with, in terms of harama, you have the machshava is a harama, but the chitzyonos, the appearance, you're doing something that no one, anyone looking would look at it and say, oh, look at that, he needed to make a seed, or whatever. So it's not as severe as being okay or some of the arises somehow just based on matzah.
Meaning in this case, he actually is using a lesura kufo. Nobody can deny that he's using it lesura kufo. That's kind of sad on it. And so that alone might justify the harama. I mean, you're using a lesura kufo, okay? It could be that you didn't need to. Right, so we talked about, using a klisha malachto le'iser, right, can I use a pen to point at the Sefer Torah, right, when a klisha malachto le'heter, right, is available, like the silver yash. Right, so Mr. Beer says that that's, that's not allowed, and so I guess the question would be, right, is, can you move the fishnets when there's a chair available? And Mr. Beer will probably say that you can't. Like you can't move the fishnets when chairs are available, which might, by the way, suggest that there were no chairs available, or that you particularly needed, right, to use the fishnets. Right, so again, if that's the case, then there's no haram at all. And again, like, why are the posts invoking this particular sugya? Let's just finish. So we had two options so far. Right, option number one, right, was. Maybe he was moving it so that Rav Kahana could sit on it. Option number two, it was on the chair, and he moved it so that Rav Kahana could sit on the chair and not be blocked by the fishnet. And Ibai's Ema says the Gemara. Hasam mechama letzel hava. And over there, right, the fishnets had nothing to do with Rav Kahana, right, and he was just moving it. Okay, so again, for Rashi, the question is, why is Rav emphasizing, bring it so that Rav Kahana can sit on it? So option number one is he was trying to teach the students something. He was trying to teach them, right, that only for the sake of sitting, right, and not for the sake of anything else, not with Sora from the Kolo. Right, this option number two now is, is that maybe he's saying this because this is necessary, right, in order to justify moving it, right, mechamel itself. Okay, so then he really wanted to move it mechamel itself. If all that he did, right, was move it, so then perhaps it would be aser. But now that he said move it to Rav Kahana, can sit on it, so that justifies, right, that justifies the movement. Almost as if that when you're doing a harama, you're supposed to articulate, right, the permissible one, the one that you say then, right, becomes more dominant, and the one that remains unsaid becomes, you know, becomes the non-dominant one. Okay, so this is option number one, right? A strange, you know, chumrah which would result, which I don't think the paskin like, right, is that maybe every time you're doing a harama, you need to speak out, right, and you know, speak out the permissible intention, right? I'm moving this you know, laptop or this hammer because I need the space to put down my salaboard, right, and my plate, right? That might you know, emerge from what, you know, Rav as interpreted by Rashi. This is the first Gemara about harama. Let's take a look at the second Gemara, and then we're going to have to compare, right, the two of them and see whether the parameters are a little bit different. Rav Mari Bar Rachel, Havalei Hahi Beisad Yusa B'Shimsha. He had certain blankets,
felt pillows,
right? Felt pillows, right? Some sort of felt pillows.
Felt
like yeah. No, the hats are made out of felt, right? So and they were in the sun, and you know, the sun is not good for furniture, right? It can bleach these things, it can cause them to become stiff, and so he wanted to move it out of the sun. So also Lakami de Rava, he came to Rava. And Amarle, he said, Mahu Lataltu Linu, am I allowed to move these pillows out of the sun? Now, before we even read any further, I'll tell you there's amazing machlokas about what this shaila was and this whole dialogue. I'm going to follow Machlokas HaShakel's interpretation. So, it's klishim alachto leheter, right? So klishim alachto leheter, you should be allowed, right, to move mechama l'tzel, right? But we know that in the times of the Gemara, there was a major machlokas whether klishim alachto leheter could be moved mechama l'tzel or could not be moved mechama l'tzel. And Rav Mari Bar Rachel presumably felt that klishim alachto leheter could not be moved mechama l'tzel. So the question becomes, right, can I create a circumstance, an artificial circumstance, right, can I borrow the coconut, so to speak, right, in order to justify moving these pillows? So this seems to be the shaila, and am I allowed to move these pillows? Again, Rav Mari Bar Rachel knows the answer, right, according to his Rebbe, and he's not allowed to move the pillows. Now he wants to know, am I allowed to create the harama if I articulate some sort of a permissible tzorech gufo or tzorech mekomo reason, right, would that be enough? Or is my forbidden intention, my saving the pillows, right, or, you know, going to interfere, you know, even if I articulate some sort of a more permissible intention?
What's the problem over here?
We passed in his mutter. Rav Mari's Rebbe passed in that it was aser. We don't accept his fact, right? But you know, he was following his own rabbi's fact, and so he needed to figure out, based on his set of rules, whether it was mutter or asr. Because klisha malachto leheter, according to some, may only be moved with tzorech gufo l'tzorech mekomo, not mechama l'tzel. So this is mechama l'tzel. He wants to move it mainly to rescue it from getting damaged. His rabbi said you're not allowed to do that, even by klishim alachto leheter. Again, we totally reject that, but in the Shas of the Gemara, when you open Shiloh, some rabbis passing yes, some passing no, and the Mar Baruch of passing is also.
So in the context of this issue, he's still looking to understand how can I do a harama.
Yeah, that's the master's HaShakel's understanding. So Amar Le, Rav said, Shari, it's allowed. Rava. So Rava said, yeah, he said it's allowed. Why? Because, you know, you could use a felt pillow, you could sleep on it, right, you can lean on it, whatever it is. So, okay, so even though you're mainly doing it, mechama l'tzel, right, but, right, since you're probably, you know, you're going to use it, once you bring it inside, that already is going to be okay. So then Rav Mari said, isli achlina, I have one already inside. So Rava answered, Chazu la'orchin. But what if you have guests? Okay, so bring it inside, right, for those future possible guests that will visit your house. So then Rav Mari said, Isli nami l'orchim. I have spare one. Right, in other words, I have enough also for future possible guests. Well, how many does he have? How many pillows does he have? 5? 10? And let's say he's got 10 pillows at home. Right, but maybe he'll have 15 guests.
It's not the Derek.
Is he going to get any? When Rava says, l'orchim, right? Did the Rava ask him, do you normally have guests or not? Or did he just say, yeah, okay, you know, you might have guests. You never know.
You get 2 guests. You don't get 25 guests.
Mari Baraka was an important person. Maybe he got more. Right. Okay. So that's also a little bit of a havama. So in the end, Rava said, Amar le gilita daitech dekarava sir lecha. You know, I can see that you hold like Rava. That's why you're not just taking the mechama letzel heter. The kuli al mashari. Everyone else is allowed to move it even without these guests. But ledidach asir for you, right? It's asir. In other words, right, I understand, right, like an Ashkenazi posi who's passing in for Sfardim has got to pass in Sfardi halacha, right, and the Rava who's passing in for Ramari Baraka has got to pass in based on what Ramari Baraka's rabbi would have told him, right, and so Ramari Baraka was just asking about the harama, and in the end of the day he said, right, because you hold Mechamel Etzel is Asur, and you don't have a good enough harama, right, therefore you have to leave your pillows in the sun. Okay. Could you cover them?
You definitely
can close the blinds. Yeah, I would think you should be able to cover them. You should be able to cover them. Makes sense. You should be able to cover them. Again, for us, we would just move them because it's Klishim Alasko Maheter. But within his system, he should be able to cover them.
So, a lot of pillows go again.
Rava held you can move it without any harama.
Right, so
why didn't Rava move it himself? Can I move something to somebody who's who's machmir? And that was always in yeshiva. It used to be that some people would open battles on Shabbos, some people wouldn't open battles on Shabbos, and so the ones who would open the battle for the ones who wouldn't.
It also comes up with making
or filtered wine.
Yeah, so that's just an interesting, right, on Shemitah, right, there's also questions, people who are, who don't treat Heter Mechira produce with Kedusha, and you go to their house. And, I think Postum just went to say why. No, that's opposite. It's opposite. If I hold it as Mukher, I should be allowed to do it. That's just, even if it's your property, I should be allowed to do it. Maybe out of respect for Amari Baraka, Rava didn't want to do it, like he wasn't going to go against Amari Baraka's attack, and that's Amari Baraka's own house. Maybe he was just too busy.
Seems like he was looking for a way out.
He had Kabbalah's call. He needed to be right in the in the clothes for people who asked him silence until 10 p.m. If Amari Baraka was there at 7, and so that's it. He wasn't able to leave because he had more important things to do. So this is a case.
The previous one, the Rav Kahana, you're saying some people say that might not have been.
Right, that's a machloka. So in this case, what emerges clearly is the following. Like if you don't have a pillow at home, right, then you can move this pillow, even if your main intention or original inspiration, right, was to protect this pillow from damage. Right? But if you don't have a pillow at home and you can use the pillow sometime over Sabbath, then you're allowed to move the pillow inside. Right? What happens if you have a pillow inside already and you don't have enough for guests? Are you sure that guests are going to come? Is there a possibility that guests are going to come? What's the likelihood that guests are going to come? no matter what, you're allowed to move it inside. We don't know what the details are, right? But you're allowed to move the pillow inside just to be prepared for the eventuality, right, that guests, you know, might arrive. Why can't you move the pillow when the guests come? Well, you don't have to wait for that because it's a harama. You can say, I'm moving it inside so I can be prepared, you know, for the guests. But if you already have, right, a lot of pillows inside, right, so then already it becomes forbidden. The question is, right, what changes? Why is it? Right, why can't you say, I have 10 pillows inside, maybe I'll have 15 guests? That's the question. What changes to make a harama usur once you already have enough pillows for some guests inside?
The plausibility.
Meaning, there's such a thing as a harama hanikares, and something which everybody can tell, right, that this is just an excuse to do something usur. As opposed to a harama she'ena nikares, right, which is something where people can't necessarily tell. Maybe you're doing this, right, because you really do, you know, you want to be 100%, you know, prepared for when the guests walk in. Maybe you're moving the fishnets because you kind of like to sit on fishnets, or because you don't have any chairs, right, to spare, or something along those lines. It's much more plausible, right, that the permissible intention, right, is the main one in the cases which are mutter. The case which is usr is the one where it's just clear to everybody that you're doing this as an excuse, right, to do something which is usr. So that.
Right.
No, tzorach gufo in general, that's an interesting point, right? But when we talk about tzorach gufo, we mean, right, something that you're going to use it for on Shabbos. So, like, for example, they talk about moving things, right, in the morning, right, because you're planning to use them in the afternoon, right? A kli shemalachto le'iser, and I'm moving it in the morning because, right, I want it to be ready in the afternoon. Like, let's say I put it in my pocket. I'm not planning to use it in shul, right? But I'm planning to use it, let's say, when I come home from shul. That would be considered letzorech gufo, to move it even early in the morning. So that, I think, you know, the pillows over here, you're preparing it for later in the day, and that's tzorech gufo.
But in case, you said maybe more guests will come. But that's not a need. It's only a need when they come. I can decide I'm going to do this later. I'm going to do this later. So that's a need. But it's not a need until the person comes.
It's not a need until the person comes. Is that how you like it? When the guests come, so you start scrambling to get everything ready for them? I prefer that everything be ready before the guests come. And then they come, and instead of scrambling to prepare things for them, I'm ready to give them my attention and, you know, my everything else, because everything that could be done in advance is done in advance.
Like washing glasses.
Yeah, but this.
Like, do a lot of washing glasses. Right.
A few hours later that you'll end up needing to use it, exactly.
Yeah, but that's, you will be careful.
No.
Yeah, I don't know. Later. But do it now, even though the guests will come for Shabbat Shidduch. But then, you know, you say here, you know they come. But what if you really don't know if the guests are coming, but you still, this is,
if you convince yourself that guests might come and that you're actually anxious, right, that everything should be prepared for them, again, as long as it passes that plausibility test, right, and to a certain extent, right, you can, you know, there is a certain measure of sincerity, whatever percentage it needs, 10%, 20%, 30% of sincerity, right, so that's something that will be allowed. But again, right, if you already have a lot of pillows, right, and you just, you know, you can't either convince yourself, right, or do it in a way that's convincing to observers, right, that this is genuinely being done for tzorach gufo or tzorach mekomo, so then it would not be allowed. So I think we'll pick up tomorrow trying to apply this to the case of switching around the seating arrangement. Right? Is that something which is being done, right, with the threshold, you know, above or below the threshold of sincerity? And is it above or below the threshold of plausibility? When an onlooker, right, say, oh, you know, he's doing this because he actually wants to see the room from a different angle, And or is the onlooker going to say, oh, he's doing this because he wants an excuse to move the hammer or the laugh pad?
Oh. Yeah.